Just to answer your question a little bit more about doctors who attempt to migrate and are unsuccessful. You know, just in general, this sort of work is not well supported or funded in the world. Many of us are doing this on the margins of work that pays. So it's hard to get information about these things. I do have a student right now who is studying Sudanese physicians in the United States who are trying to establish themselves, and he tapped into the Sudanese network and has administered a survey, and we're producing a paper on that. So we'll start to get at the edges of some of this. Okay, well, thank you very much. I have no relationships I care to disclose to anybody here today, and none that I'm obligated to. Cindy Sousa was my MPH graduate student a few years ago when she conducted this study for her thesis. She's now a doctoral student in social work at the University of Washington, and she had to attend another conference this week. So she asked me to make this presentation for her. She's trying to get on a faculty somewhere and seems to think that's important. So there's a growing literature on armed conflict as a major determinant of health. It's more and more coming into the realm of public health professionals to think about primary and secondary prevention of war, and not merely constraining ourselves to our traditional and historical role of cleaning up afterwards. There was, for example, a special edition of The Lancet just this year on war and the relationship of health workers to war. My own university put on a conference on war and global health last year, a very successful conference run by mostly students, attracted 500 registrants. We have actually canned that conference as a with a set of CDs with the tools necessary to put on a conference like that. If anybody wants to take that CD and put on a conference in their own university, we would encourage that. And APHA has reportedly made statements about war and its relationship to health. And in 2009, we passed a fairly comprehensive resolution on war, and calling on health workers to engage in prevention. So today I'll be presenting Cindy's work assessing the role of the Israeli Defense Forces in blocking the movement of ambulances and mobile clinics in the West Bank of Palestine. This was published in Global Public Health earlier this year. So this presentation is based on that work. I don't know how many of you are engaged in running a health system. Anybody here actually work in administration in a health system? Okay, so a few of you might be able to relate to this, but it's a hard job to do in the best of circumstances. And imagine doing it in circumstances where it is challenging and very difficult from in terms of having many external obstacles. So Palestinian-controlled territory in the West Bank is shrinking, and it's highly controlled by occupying Israeli Defense Force units and their security wall. And this has implications for the conduct of health services there. The wall, let's just talk about that. It was begun in 2002, and it's a series of blockages. It's not all a tall cement wall, but parts of it are. This is a 27-foot high portion of the wall with concrete barriers. Other places it consists of guarded and unfriendly fences, some of them electric and barbed, with cameras and/or trenches. In other places it includes watchtowers with snipers every 400 meters. This town of Qalqilya is completely surrounded by the wall, with only a single military checkpoint as the entrance and exit to the city. So we're thinking about this, again, not just in political context or aesthetics or, you know, many dimensions. We're thinking about this in terms of trying to run a health system and get care to people and sustain a health workforce. So Cindy worked closely with the Palestinian Medical Relief Society to do this research, and this is an organization that runs programs in Gaza and the West Bank and has a long history of managing, interacting with, and or avoiding the Israeli Defense Forces. Cindy accompanied ambulances and mobile clinic drivers as they drove to and from patient care situations, including transfers for emergency or specialty care and attending 5 standing clinics. She also accompanied administrators and the mental health team on their daily drives for 10 weeks. She observed at least 50 checkpoints in the West Bank as a passenger in a taxi or with ambulances or mobile clinics. And during her checkpoint observations, she had a checklist to collect information on the time of the wait, how many vehicles were waiting, if there were ambulances in the queue, the behavior of the soldiers at the checkpoints, and any special notations. And throughout, she had conversations with those who she was accompanying, doctors, lab technicians, nurses, community health workers, ambulance drivers, administrators, and mental health workers. And these were her primary questions for the workers in her interviews, the effects of the occupation on health, the effects on delivery of health care, and views on the security measures in relation to health delivery. She also reviewed driver logs and incident reports to gather quantitative data on problems. And her findings were, not unexpectedly, that the occupation undermines both patient care and the well-being of health workers, and yet, even so, health workers have found creative ways to maintain their job performance and their resilience in the face of all this. So clinic and ambulance drivers encountered frequent delays in their attempt to deliver care. These were related to road closures, related to settlements. So Israeli settlements in the area have closed roads. Delays at checkpoints, curfews imposed on towns and villages, searches of medical vehicles, and verbal and physical abuse from authorities. The 50 checkpoints she monitored involved delays with wait times ranging from 2 minutes to half an hour. Regular delays were experienced of around 15 minutes. Occasionally a checkpoint was empty or the soldiers simply waved the team through, but this was the exception. Ambulance drivers described waits of up to 3 hours and times when they were not allowed access to their patients either entirely or without significant interruption. This checkpoint has more than 50 cars waiting to pass. This was her picture. On at least one trip, she said, the vehicle was stopped at 5 different checkpoints. Health providers were required to show identification for every passenger in the vehicle. On this and every trip, workers were frequently mandated to leave the vehicle to stand for inspection. They were often commanded to open each door of the vehicle, to open various compartments in the vehicle. And while medical providers should, under international law, as we heard from Len, be allowed expedited passage, waits at the checkpoints were commonplace. Palestinian healthcare workers expressed, however, reluctance to claim this privilege because they felt that jumping the line sort of has cultural implications and it sort of discounts the misery of others who are obligated to wait. This was a quote from an ambulance driver. Last week I was trying to get through Hawara checkpoint. The total trip took me about 5 to 6 hours. I was at the checkpoint for 2 hours. There was a patient who had just had open heart surgery and he was going to the hospital for a checkup. The soldier at the checkpoint said I didn't have the proper license to get through, made us wait in the hot sun. This past week was very hot and the soldiers made the ambulance stop in the sun. This was very bad for patients. Administrative duties of healthcare planners and managers are also interrupted. Cindy reported administrators were scheduled to attend a meeting with donors in Nablus, which is a town 2 districts away. Israeli military personnel at the checkpoint into Nablus refused entry to the administrators, even though they were riding in an official vehicle of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. And this resulted in having to move the meeting to a different town that was accessible. In total, travel to the meeting with international donors took almost 7 hours due to the restrictions imposed on the checkpoints. Another quote from an ambulance driver: while I was driving, two tanks stopped my ambulance and blocked me. Two to three soldiers were shooting at the ground and the sky. They told me to get out with my hands up. Then the soldiers strip searched me. They made me take off all my clothes. The soldiers made me stay 2 hours in the hot sun. They turned off the ambulance so there was no air conditioning for the patient. I kept begging them to let me go check the patient. Finally, they let me, and when I went to check the patient's pulse, I realized he had died. He was 40 years old. Patient care is compromised. Those were about delays. This is about patient care. Patient care is compromised for both preventive care as well as routine follow-up to chronic illness, and of course for emergency care. Another quote from a PMRS doctor: during the first intifada, I was working in a small village. She took the names out of the villages. There were 50,000 people under continuous curfew for 11 days. I used to sneak to the village for those days to provide health care. When I was caught by soldiers, I was threatened to be shot in the health center itself, despite the Red Crescent head coming. I was under fire several times in this area. I remember negotiating with Israeli Defense Force officers, "You don't want me to open the health center?" Cindy found health personnel reported being repeatedly harassed, arrested, being used as a human shield, physical aggression. Being unpredictably detained is very disruptive to care, of course, but also to the ability of a health system to retain its health workers, who become discouraged and stressed. I think the thing that struck me most about when Cindy talked to me about this work is about the humiliation that health workers face and being subject to routine search and seizure, especially by quite young soldiers who are significantly their junior, was most insulting. Another quote from an ambulance driver: I was driving the mobile clinic and I was trying to get through a checkpoint. The soldiers said, "I can't go through." I was arguing with them and trying to tell them that I had doctors and medicine with me and I needed to pass. I had to get out of the ambulance. The soldier put my arms behind my back and slammed me into the glass on the ambulance. In the end, they would not let us pass, though, and we had to turn back. Cindy did find quite a spirit of solidarity and resistance, however. She found health workers to be creative and flexible and reported their commitment to their communities is what keeps them on the job. Another quote: if you were in my place, you would do the same thing. You would keep working. This is a matter of doing something, helping your people. It's a matter of feeling that you are responsible and you have to do something. You are a doctor, a healthcare provider, and you should do something to help. There are successes to think of, and the satisfaction of the beneficiaries gives you more and more energy to continue. So the Israeli occupation of Palestine has compromised the health of Palestinians and the health system that serves them. I think that's an objective finding. The Palestinian Medical Relief Society views health as an entry point for social change and community development. I think that was true in early United States organizing around health. Community health centers emerged from that sort of concept of solidarity and the use of health as an entry to community organizing. But clearly the best thing for the health of both Palestinian and Israelis would be a lasting regional peace. I invite you to the Peace Caucus Roundtable discussion tomorrow afternoon, where we will talk about that 2009 APHA resolution that we passed supporting health worker prevention of war. And these are Cindy's acknowledgments. Yeah. Questions? Yeah.
I would like to say that this is the descriptions are very vast and colorful. I would like to ask a question that is maybe provocative, and probably because the robot is not here. How
So she worked with the Palestinian Medical Relief Society, which sponsors ambulances and mobile clinics, and in her relationship with that entity over the course of the 3 summers where she did this research, she was associated with them and their administrators and their healthcare workers, and she accompanied their vehicles. Question? Yeah, so how will this research be used to make change here in the Middle East or elsewhere? You know, I think as social justice researchers, it's our obligation to document these situations and publish them in the literature, which she did, which helps to build the evidence base for making change. And then when you're ready to make change, you do things like get involved in APHA and pass resolutions and go to meetings and start to do that. Yeah. Oh, and you have a question too? Okay, you go next.
Yeah. I was wondering whether Cindy interviewed any Israelis, like either at checkpoints or other places, to get an idea of, you know, what the basis of their policy is and how Cindy's can better, you know, deal with it, that they understood a little bit better what the reasons were.
Yeah. So her human subjects authorization allowed her access to health workers attached to the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. It did not allow her to talk to Israeli Defense Force people, and to my knowledge, she did not. Len?
Was there any inspection procedure that the Israelis had for the ambulances with respect to carrying military equipment?
So did the Israeli Defense Force soldiers have a procedure, a written procedure for inspecting ambulances?
Whether it was written or not, was there a regular procedure that they used kind of along the lines of the question in terms of what the protocols were?
That's a really good question. Were there actual protocols written or otherwise for ambulance inspection to see if they were carrying bombs or not carrying bombs or had patients or not patients? I don't know that. It seems likely that they had them, but I don't know what they were.
Just to follow, when I did some work back when the conflict was more active on the West Bank, there were procedures where the ICRC actually did the inspection. I don't know if that is carried through to the normal course of life.
So they would have had procedures, ICRC.
And everybody agreed to them.
Yeah.
But I don't know if those still exist. That was during a time of fairly active conflict.
So what years was that?
It was like 2002 or 3.
Okay, so that was before this.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah. Gil?
Anyway, just a comment. When the barriers were being constructed, we did a survey to look at delays in both health workers and patients coming, and which we documented to be substantial. But we also looked in the educational system, and exactly the same pattern was happening in the educational system as well. So it's a social kind of issue.
So the same things in terms of denial of access to the population.
Yeah, and teachers not being able to reach schools, students not being able to reach schools as well.
Right. So the wall and the various security measures block people's access to education. I'm just repeating for the... Thank you, Gilbert. Yeah?
I was wondering if there is any follow-up research that's being planned or considered to look at the specific health outcomes, mortality associated with these delays, and quantify that to sort of...
Right, so is there health outcomes research for Palestinian populations? So... Cindy and I recently reviewed a series of a couple papers that should be coming out soon. Forget what journal they were for, but these were on nutritional outcomes for kindergartners in Palestinian territories, and they did various associations with mental health of their mothers, knowledge of their mothers, and the correlation to various perceived levels of exposure to violence. Those were good papers, and they did find nutritional outcomes for the kids exposed to the most violence.
If I can comment on that, too.
Yeah.
There are two Israeli human rights groups that have reported on a number of deaths resulting from delays in detention. Those were reports by human rights organizations as opposed to academic researchers, and you'd have to look to see what kind of methods they used for the quality of the research. But there is reporting on that question.
So why don't you take over here for the rest of the... I mean, people may have questions in general, yeah?
Is this a question for Amy?
Well, it was just going to be a follow-up on that. So the PMRS, that sale, and you know, the position of human rights, is all the documentation on their websites of incidents, as you say, they haven't necessarily been validated. I think that, that by and large, these things are the accusations of ambulances carrying bombs or schools being homes for terrorists. I think that largely, it depends on what sort of evidence you accept, but largely those things have been discounted. And there were various accusations at the beginning of the second incidents, which largely were discounted. But so even then, can you ever say that these incidents are impossible? That's impossible that a school child could have a bomb in a backpack or that an ambulance could have something private. You can never say that. So the question is, what level of inspection is really necessary, whether we should have standard procedures agreed to by all parties, which I think might be good. There was an ICRC report about protection of health workers, too, not just for patients, that might be impacted by all. But I think we have to think about how we move forward in terms of protecting people needing medical care.
I mentioned earlier that as part of the ICRC campaign, they're conducting workshops, and one of them will be specifically about checkpoints. So I encourage those of you who are interested in this issue to get involved in that process. We have a little under 10 minutes left, and if people have questions on the prior presentations or more general comments about these issues, now is the time. If not, we don't have any problem ending slightly early. Any comments or questions? Further discussion? Before getting to that, can we hear a little more about your own experience?
Sure. So this is the third trip that we went in. We're going in as part of Washington's social responsibility. We've been going in intermittently, more recently doing service work. I'm a pediatric urologist at the University of Washington. There's a, from my experience, I found the primary care actually in Gaza region to be quite good. And people say it is a leftover of Israeli settlements.
On the question, it's a very large question because the anti-terror laws and material support laws have had a major impact not only on health but in many other realms of activity. And a couple of years ago, or last year, the Supreme Court actually interpreted the law extremely broadly, even to apply to advocacy on behalf of peace initiatives by what is labeled a terrorist group, and those were characterized by the Supreme Court as material support of terrorism. These issues have also arisen in Somalia, where we have a group there, the Al-Shabaab, which is labeled a terrorist group, and it has deeply affected the ability of humanitarian organizations to work there because of these prohibitions. If you're funded, you need a license from the Treasury Department in that case to provide services there, and humanitarian groups have to do various kinds of investigations to make sure the money is not ending up in the hands of Al-Shabaab. Because that has become such an obstacle to providing aid to keep people alive in Somalia, there have been a lot of efforts within the government to try to loosen some of the restrictions. And it really has a lot to do with differences between the way USAID and humanitarian functions at the State Department view the need and the way the Treasury Department wants to enforce its regulations. In Gaza, I think, I'm not familiar with how those regulations are enforced in Gaza, but I do think that there has been some ability of humanitarian groups to provide support there without U.S. government money. I wouldn't take what I just said as true. It's what I believe to be the case, but I don't know. But these are very serious obstacles to providing care in any situation, even a catastrophe like Somalia, where all effort should be focused on meeting needs. And groups have to figure out how to navigate these anti-terrorist rules. There's actually a group called the Charity and Security Network. I don't know their website, but if you Google Charity and Security Network, their entire function in life is to address this problem of charity and security. And any information you need about the regulations, about interpretations of how you navigate these issues, as well as how you can be involved in advocacy to address the problems, they're your source.
Some efforts, but
why don't you come to the microphone?
I think that the CDC had been doing a program, I think, starting about a year or two ago, to look at various NGOs and look at the mental health experiences that people have had. But other than that, I don't think there's been much documented. Quite a bit has been documented, and of course, deaths and injuries and serious illnesses, but I think that side is very important, and I think it's really been seriously neglected. And I think that's a major concern for international organizations, because in the U.S., there's a clear precedent that if you work in a public safety organization, that organization is required and you're entitled to receive support after dealing with disastrous situations or particular difficulties. That's a well-established precedent. That has never been established internationally and for international groups. And some organizations do provide this assistance, but others, in the interest of trying to contain costs and so forth, will do debriefing over the telephone and really not make those kind of services available in the long term. And so I think that's waiting for something bad to happen there.
I think it's why we were so interested in looking at what makes health workers stay in situations where you think, gosh, why would anybody stay here? You have a license that could take you to any country in the world. Why would you stay here? When I went to Basra in 2009, it had been about a year since there was a major incident there, which sort of changed the course of Basra for a while. And, you know, Basra was occupied by British forces, not Americans. And there was a major incident where a neurosurgeon had been dragged from his clinic and ripped apart by the whatever forces engage in such activity. And the physician community in Basra rose up together and communicated to the national government that this was not going to be tolerated, and they would all leave if this wasn't resolved. And that was the point where sort of the war took a turn in Basra, and those militia forces were cleaned up and removed from the area. And it had been fairly peaceful for a year when I arrived in 2009. So, you know, medical communities can be involved in the politics of these things when they are moved to do so. And it can really change the health status of the community when they do it.
And when we looked at the specialists moving to, sometimes they would move to areas where there was a reputation for violence and where, you know, the data would suggest a lot of serious things were going on, but there was a sense of solidarity among the medical community. There was a sense of solidarity among the families of the elites that they represented, so they felt actually more safe there than they would in other areas where those networks didn't exist.
Well, I want to thank, we have to end it now. You can, if you have a question, you can come talk to the panelists. I want to thank Gilbert and Amy, especially for not only for coming, but pitching in for Cindy Souza's presentation. And I just remind you what Amy said. There is a session tomorrow at 4:30 on follow-up on many of the issues that we discussed today. So thank you again.